Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello everyone and welcome to East Asian Studies channel of the New Books Network. Today we will be talking with Lorenzo Andolfato about his new book, 100 Days Literature, Chinese Utopian Fiction at the End of Empire, 1902-1910, published by Brill. The completion of this book has benefited from Lorenzo joining the collaborative research project called East Asian Uses of European Past, supported by the HERA Network and led by Professor Joachim Kurtz. In 100 Days Literature, Lorenzo explores the landscape of early modern Chinese fiction through the lens of the utopian novel and casts new light on some of its most peculiar, yet often overshadowed, literary specimens. Hi, Lorenzo. Thank you very much for taking the time today to talk to us about your book, 100 Days Literature, Chinese Utopian Fiction at the End of Empire, 1902-1910.
Hi, Victoria. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And the book is fantastic. Let me say that just, you know, to start at the very beginning. And great. Yeah, I had a lot of fun reading it. And, you know, before I get into more details about the book, I wanted to ask whether you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and the way you came to Asian studies, you know, about your interest in Chinese utopian novels, specifically at the beginning of the century in China.
Yeah, I can do that. So as for the first question, where do I come from? I'm an Italian scholar. I studied in Venice at the Ca' Foscari University of Venice. I was trained as a sinologist, so I would say that I moved slowly from the classics to the more modern and contemporary stuff. I completed my PhD there between the Ca' Foscari University of Venice and the Jean Moulin Lyon 3 University of Lyon in France in a joint degree program in 2015. After a few months looking for jobs, I landed in Hong Kong at the Department of Translation of the Chinese University of Hong Kong for 1 year as a postdoc researcher. And then I moved to Heidelberg, where I am right now. In this three-year window, I managed to transform what was originally my PhD dissertation into this book we're talking about. As for how I ended up, well, the basic question, so how I decided to study East Asian languages and Chinese in particular is, well, I have a funny anecdote about that.
Oh, please, sure.
It comes from when I was in high school and we were doing modern and contemporary European history. And I realized that we were not doing much about what was going on in East Asia in particular. So I knew nothing about what was going on over there. And I remember there was one chapter in my history book that, if I remember correctly, it was using both Wei Chiles and Pinyin for transcribing Chinese names.
Oh.
And so wow. I found myself very confused about whether it was reading about the same persons, you know. If these really similar names were actually referring to the same Mao Zedong, the same Deng Xiaoping, and so on and so forth. And I remember that I asked my history professor, and he was a bit confused, and he wasn't sure about his answer. And so that made me realize that I had absolutely no cognition, knowledge of the language spoken in China in this case, the history of the country, the literature, the philosophy. And so I thought that was a good enough reason to, when it came to choosing a path in my university education to.
That's a very nice anecdote. That's a very nice anecdote. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense because specifically in, you know, history textbooks and, you know, some parts of Europe, Eastern Europe as well, you know, you have this dual system that confuses many, many people, myself included. So, right. So, that's a very nice start. And, you know, just to get into the matter of things, the book, as I saw it, but, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is comprised of 5 chapters and the introduction and the conclusions as well, right? And it makes an intervention in the way utopian novels developed during the fast-changing times, specifically during transitional periods as the one between 1902 and 1910. In the introduction, you mentioned the tumultuous history of the end of the Qing dynasty and the different cultural investments when developing the utopian novel, as well as the way in which, you know, the novel functions and what the goals are and so on. So, you know, my question about this would be whether you could tell us more about the way you trace the genealogy of the utopian novel in your book.
Yes, of course. So I must admit that my relying on the label of utopian writing and so on is I wouldn't say forced, but it's a very conscious decision. Well, I realized originally that was not my initial plan. I wasn't sure I was going to end up working within the frame of utopian fiction. I ended up using this perspective in order to make sense of what looked to me like a blind spot in what had been written before about that particular time. The major blind spot is the one that posits the May 4th as the main threshold for defining where modern Chinese literature start. And I'm not the first one to say this. I mean, there's a lot of David Wang in the Found the Circle of Splendor wrote a lot about it. And Catherine Yeh and Nathaniel Isaacson. And so I'm not the first one to make these claims. The thing is that even though much of old-timey scholarship about modern Chinese literature takes the 1919 as a sort of threshold period from which everything starts, everything new starts, if you actually look right a little bit, let's say a few years before that, there was so much going on that there were so many movements and tendencies and trends and experiments that most of the time they didn't go anywhere, but they were trying to go somewhere. And among these different kinds of writings, there was the political novel that Catherine Yeh wrote about, science fantasy that David Wang wrote about. There was science fiction coming out, the detective novel. So I thought that was my starting point. I also realized that many of these labels that came about around that time were also very artificial. And oftentimes it is very difficult to pinpoint a particular genre to a particular work. So it takes some, there's a certain flexibility that makes for a very cool discursive space to explore for people like me interested in utopian writing and science fiction.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, the end of the, even before the end of the Qing dynasty, right, you had a lot of cultural work happening and, as you said, a lot of movements that, you know, remain for some reason or another understudied up to this day. And, you know, it's just it's, you know, like a child in a, you know, for Christmas in a candy store, you know, it's just so fascinating. But
that's so true. Most of these novels are so massively how to say, what's the word there? Prolific. Many writers are so prolific and write in such a maximalist way. I remember I was talking to Darwin actually some months ago, and I think one of an interesting way to look at it would be to consider it as sort of pre-modern postmodernism going on, in that the medium of the novel and the language were explored in such a prolific and bizarre and atypical and unexpected way, very self-referential, very self-aware, that one could say, and I think I make this claim somewhere in the book, I may be misremembering now, but they were both two steps ahead and still one step behind, or still one or two steps behind. And so that's why this sort of lack of synchronicity kind of characterized this period as a very particular one, and also for a long time relegated it at a sort of in the background as a sort of minor, weird, kind of weird uncle kind of literature, you know.
For sure, yes. And there's much to be said about these, almost as a, you know, cultural kind of dance, right? The two steps forward, one step back, I like to think about it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, it is a dance, because you, in this huge corpus of unexplored literature, you can find some. I read, and just to be clear, I'm not claiming I am some sort of expert on the whole, but because there was so many things going on, so many texts and genres and writers and philosophers turned writers that. I still have my reading to do, you know. I was lucky enough to stumble upon this corpus of texts, to put together this corpus of texts that made sense if read through the utopian lens. And so that's what I ended up doing. And I did it for a very simple reason. I was very interested in working on Chinese science, on the origins of Chinese science fiction. And as I started work, first year of PhD, we're talking about here, 2012. And as I started working on that, I realized that somebody, as it happens often, that somebody else just happened to have just written a full dissertation about it. So I read that dissertation. I was like, yep, that was what I wanted to write, so I better find something else. And of course, I'm talking about my colleague and friend, Nathaniel Isaacson. I think he's in at North Carolina State University. And he published a couple of years ago, Celestial Empires, which is a history of Chinese science fiction that starts from the same time frame that I use in my book. So I figured, so I cannot talk about science fiction, but it's pretty clear that this network, or like cloud of texts, were using science fiction, were using different generic perspectives to talk about the future, and most of the times these discourses about the future turn into ideal versions, idealizations of the times to come, some imagination of post-colonial futures in which the condition of early modern, late imperial China, which was one of subjugation, was being overturned, and the young China, as Nietzsche put it, would take back its place at the center of the world order. And so oftentimes these discourses would take, once converted into, translated into novels, they would turn into what we would understand now as utopian novels in the manner of Edward Bellamy's or William Morris, or, you know, those authors I mentioned later on in the book.
Yes, yes, and I have a question about that.
Sure.
Yes. Later
yeah,
on.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. Right. And I think to because you just mentioned the word fiction, right? And I think you do you ponder on the role of fiction and, you know, its function according to Liang Qichao, and then you analyze that in relation to Cai Yuanpei's short story New Year's Dream. So you know, I was fascinated, and I would love our listeners to know more about you know, the way we can theorize the role fiction plays and how it evolves and mutates in the utopian novel, and specifically at this you know, watershed moment at the beginning of the 20th century that, you know, is so fruitful and so fascinating.
So as for the so this may sound counterintuitive, considering that in the book I realize I tend to lose myself a lot into pseudo-theoretical digressions, and this remains quote, between us, but one of the main critiques I got from during the peer review process was me getting lost in like this theoretical. I wanted to write theoretically. I wanted to write in a sophisticated way about very simple things, and that was a mistake that was pointed out to me. Anyway, all I'm saying is that we don't need to do much theorizing about this kind of novels, in that the theorizing was going on itself back then. There were Yan Xiao was not Lu Xun, Fan Tianxiao. They were all these people. They were, before even starting to write novels, they were writing about what the novel should do or could do. So there was a high level of self-awareness about how to use this instrument that is a novel. And so I feel, in retrospect, of course, now it appears clear to me. I feel like I didn't have to theorize much about it, because most of the perspective I tried to unpack were already being unpacked back then. When you have Yan Qichao writing about how it is necessary to use fiction in order to educate the people, it was both harking back to a Confucian tradition of a sort of moralistic view on literature that would put a lot of responsibility, that would justify the writing and the enjoying of fiction only if oriented to a higher goal. It was both looking back at the older times, but he was also writing in response to, he was writing from a new moral, a moral ground. He was somehow rejecting what Perling defined as the, oh my God, I'm forgetting, the Mandarin ducks Mandarin ducks and butterflies literature. So this sort of very floaty, maybe sophisticated, but not, let's say, engaged kind of writing. So it was Yan Xiao saying that the novel should, the first function of the novel, that the power of the novel lies in its capacity to change the mind of people. He knew what he was doing, and so I kind of lost my thread here, but so this is where my theorizing around this genre comes about, and my interest when I use the label utopia, I don't really refer to the imaginary landscapes this open like described on the surface of these novels. Rather, I'm intrigued by how there's a certain discrepancy between what these authors claim they want to do. So they claim they want to give visions of the China of the future. They're going to show the people how things are going to be if we all strive for reform. So there's a sort of a first level of declarations of authorial intentions in this case. But also there's the way the texts behave and how the what is actually given in the text is not always what was claimed to be given by the author in the first place. So there's a certain discrepancy that there's something that doesn't compute and or that is missing. There are blind spots. And so this is to me what is utopian in as in it's not there, it's the non-place of the text. And this is a perspective that he adopted from a particular book. I'm not gonna lie about my sources, but I picked up this angle from the book Utopic Jeu d'Espace, which is an analysis by French semiotician Louis Marin on Thomas More's Utopia, written in, if I remember correctly, in around 1968, in which he talks about Thomas More's Utopia, not really in terms of he tries to foreground how the utopian locus of the text of More's text is not really the island that More was trying to describe, but rather the what was missing from the description of the island, and what was not to the discrepancies between the level of narration and the level of description of the text. So this is what I tried to do. This is the approach I had in mind when I started putting together and analyzing the texts that are in the book that I picked up on for my book.
Sure. It makes sense, and I think you can see it throughout the book. I mean, the introduction does a very good job at describing these lenses you are using, and also your interpretation of the term utopia. So I think after the introduction, we're all set to go into, the matter of things. And speaking of that, the first chapter appears to be the one where you define even more the terms, and you draw the connections with extant scholarship on Chinese utopian novels. And, you know, you do mention Isaacson and Ye and, you know, others and David Wong. And, I think it would be useful for the listeners to hear a bit more about the background onto which your conceptualizations take root, like, you know, the larger conversations. And you did mention these a little bit just now, but maybe just expand a little bit more.
The Lei Ching has been explored a lot, at least from the late 90s. And David Wang is like my main point of reference in that. He kind of opened that door. And at least for me, I mean, I still consider myself a pretty young and naive researcher, so probably I'm missing out on so many things. But anyway, it seems to me that this whole discovery of the Lei Ching was a fairly recent affair. And that Wang's book is from 1997. So let's say the last 20 years or so, anyway. So my point is, how do we get there? And so in the first chapter, what I tried to do was to look back at histories of Chinese fiction, discourses around Chinese fiction that were written maybe not in the very same years, in that particular decade I focus on as a critic, but soon thereafter, right? And so I looked into Hu Shi, who was writing like the, I think the 20s, about the Chinese literature of the last 50 years. I read some Lu Xun, I read Ai Ying, and so I was trying to look into these early scholars of Chinese fiction to see if they themselves picked up anything like what they wanted to talk about. And what is interesting to me is that most of the novelists, some of the novelists I engage with are not even mentioned, like if not very, very, very marginally. And those that are mentioned, such as Wu Jianren, or also known as Wu Boyao, who wrote The New Story of the Stone, he's considered like most often than not a chief example of these old-timey writers that were struggling to become modern, right? And you have a sort of change in perspective with A Ying in the 1930s, late 1930s, with the History of Late Qing Fiction, in which some elements of truly, maybe not truly revolutionary writing, but rather innovative writing are dug up. So this is what I tried to do. I tried to see whether the work of this novelist I was reading was actually recognized as such, you know? If Tsai Yuan, for example, the New Year's Dream by Tsai Yuan-pei was actually was in the radar of those who cared about literature, you know? And I was struck upon this blind spot about this genre that I call in my book conveniently, because you know you have to sell books, so you have to find out cool perspectives to talk about normal stuff. But what I call Wutoban Xiaoshuo back then was also known as Li Xiang Xiaoshuo, like speculative fiction. And this you could find the mentions of this genre in the horn titles of the serializations of this book. So the title, the four small characters on top of the title on the upper corner of the page, they would mention like Wutoban or Li Xiang, but it was overall quite dismissed. Yan Cixiao, I don't remember the title, where he wrote it, but he somewhere gives a list of genres that were, all the rage back then. And so he gives this series of different kinds of writing, like the political novel, the military novel, the romantic novel, the scientific adventure. But there's little mention of utopian writing as such. It was almost like an unspoken agreement that if you look at fiction as a tool for cultivating a new nation and its citizens, then of course it's going to be utopian. You know, of course you're going to talk about how things are going to be. So this is to me the interesting blind spot that prompted me to actually foreground this label of utopian writing, because it's there. At least I tried to argue for that. So.
Right, and it's very informative for us today to use this lens, you know, and look back at the ways in which it was or it wasn't labeled as such, right? And, you know, the reasons for which it wasn't, and, you know, what does it say about, you know, the spirit of the time or, you know, the political views that people had at that time, not to think about this type of literature the way we do today, right? So I think just by using this lens, you are implicitly raising questions, you know, that I'm very sure others will pick up very soon. I think it's really very interesting. And, you know, any blind spot the way you're describing it might just open a door to very... Yeah, you know, very cool.
That I think to do that, in the that future,
right?
Sorry if I interrupt you, but maybe using this expression a lot, like blind spots. Finding blind spots is what we do as academics, right? We try to find some angles, the angles that are not explored, and we try to write about it. So there's that, I think, but it works in different layers, right? There are the blind spots of recent scholarship, at least before the 1990s, having somehow dismissed the Late Qing as a sort of transitionary period that was not as interesting and as the classics that were before and the truly new literature that came with the May 4th. So that's a blind spot. But the blind spot was also the blind spot going on back then. This sort of like implied unspoken vision of literature as something that has an encoded a utopian goal.
Sure, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, not as a blind spot, but, you know, sharing some sort of similarities. I think with that in mind, we can move forward to discussing a little bit your second chapter. That where, you know, you talk about two unfinished novels, specifically Liang Tichao's Xin Zhongguo Wei Lai Ji and Chen Tianhua's Shi Zihou, right? And these seem to be, as you say, you know, useful starting points for the understanding of utopian thinking and writing as a practice of displacement of historical consciousness. I think you do have, you know, a very nice kind of description at the beginning of the chapter in which you're saying that you're using this idea of the unfinished novel to your advantage and to develop your own thinking. Yeah, so that's kind of my cue to ask you to say more about the second chapter.
Of course. But, you know, I'm not going to lie about this. These are not easy novels to read. The kind of language that they're written with is something that is changing day by day, day after day, and so we're not there yet with a truly modern Putonghua. We're of course centuries away from proper classical Chinese. So it's something. It's a weird animal, let's say. And so it took me a long time to go through these novels, to be honest. And I started to realize that when I was constructing my corpus, I realized that many novels were incomplete, unfinished. And it was so frustrating because, you know, you take the time to, you like delve into the text and you struggle because it's freaking incomprehensible at times. And you try to make sense of it, and then it just stops, and you realize so now what? What should I do? Do I just throw away whatever I read so far? And the thing is that unfinished novels, unfinished literary projects, unfinished philosophical projects, historiographical projects were something pretty common back then, or at least common enough that you would notice that if you really dig into into what was being published, you have these many projects that were like very, what's the word? Very ambitious at the beginning, and that they turned out into nothing. And like the Liang Qichao's history of the Xin Zhongguo Wei Lai Ji, it was supposed to be the first element of a trilogy that would comprise the future of New China, the future of old China, which was supposed to be a dystopian text. And then the new peach blossom spring, the Xin Tao Hua Yuan Ji, which was, and so it was, you know, and Liang Qichao actually took the time to write an essay, a sort of a commercial trailer-like essay in which he was saying it was going to publish in this new magazine, and in this new magazine it was going to serialize these three novels, right? Of which the Xin Zhongguo Wei Lai Ji, it was the first installment. And so, you know, I think, I assume that readers back then were maybe hyped to see what was going to happen with this project. But he eventually ended up writing five chapters, you know, and he just abandoned the project. And honestly, I don't know why. I didn't find anything, any document, letter, diary entry, or whatever, that in which Liang Qichao himself talks about why he stopped writing, he stopped working on that project. He was being exiled, so he was traveling all over the place. So I assume that was not his main concern. Anyway, so there's one element which is the unfinished work are pretty common. There's another major text that somehow counterintuitively I don't mention much in my book, which is the Wutobang Youji, the Travel to Utopia, which, you know, it's the title is pretty obvious, so one would reasonably ask me why didn't you include it in the book. And because that's mostly what they would consider science fiction, and Isaacson wrote a lot about it already, so I thought it was... Anyway, it doesn't matter. This novel was unfinished as well, so there are many unfinished novels, which is fine in general, but if you look at the... If you adopt the utopian perspective, then it becomes pretty fascinating to me, in which it seems to me... So I don't know if you how familiar you are with Thomas More's Utopia, the original genre founding book, but there's in one of the letters that work as paratext of More's Utopia, the narrator is being asked. So is Rafael Itlode is being asked. So where is this island you talk about? Where did you go? Where did you find this ideal society that you keep telling us about? And then the narrator, the story goes that as the narrator tries to answer the question and give you the actual coordinates of the location of Utopia, somebody start coughing, and so the first person narrator who's providing the story claims that he didn't hear the explanation of where Utopia is, right? And this is often interpreted in a of course, in a metaphorical way, in that there is, when it comes to utopia, you have to posit a sort of shift outside of history. So you're not given the way you get to utopia. You're just given the figure of utopia, which is somewhere far away, and it's somewhere that is not really reachable. And this is the potential of the idea. It posits like a radical otherness that could undermine and unset your preconception, your own ideological immemorial, so to say. And so it was fascinating to me that you have these texts that claim that they want to represent the utopia of future China, of post-colonial China. But when it actually comes to doing that, to giving you that image, these texts just vanish into nothingness. You know, they just stop somewhere in the middle, and then you're left there wondering. So, where is this image of the future that we were promised? You know, which I think it's a pretty fascinating way of looking at what the genre was trying, this kind of writing was trying to do in the first place. So I kind of pushed the logic of the argument to the actual physicality of the text being unfinished, of us not having chapters, basically.
Right. And it's a meta gesture, right, towards writing and creating the hype and, you know, probably the whole thinking process, who knows. But, you know, you stop short of it in a gesture that somehow continues by itself, but we don't know, so that probably has a lot of potential to still be unraveled, right?
And you know, this kind of writing, it came about right after the 100 years. That's where the title of my book comes from. The 100 days reform. So these people were writing utopian novels because they just realized that when they tried to implement those measures of reform in the actual place where they were living, it didn't turn out well. They were either killed or exiled. So in this perspective, the utopian fiction was already was a genre that was basically recognizing a failure. Because, you know, if you know how to get to a better place, you get there. You know, you're not stuck in the novel. You're not stuck fantasizing about it.
Right, stuck or, you know, some sort of continuity, right, between, you know, the historical reality and the narrative about the history itself, you know. So there's some sort of porous borders, from what you're saying, that appears to have been constructed there, right? And, right, so speaking of historical coordinates and contours, I think chapter 3 presents us with a provisional detour from these matters at the during the late Qing period and also late Qing fiction. And I think the chapter comes out as looking at quote unquote China as the object of representation of the other. And I think this is the first chapter where you do comparative work or comparative analysis between, Edward Bellamy's Looking Forward, 2000 to 2008.
Looking backward.
Oh, sorry. Yes, looking backward. I'm sorry. I was looking at the...
He's forward and he's looking backward.
Yes, right. right, so that was published in United States in 1888. And then Arthur Dudley's Brinton's Looking Further Backward, 1890, right?
Exactly,
These are on one hand, and then Kang Youwei and Liang Qichao on the other, right? So, and then further in the chapter, you also juxtapose Liang Qichao to Timothy Richard. Just if you could expand more on the work of comparison and the very productive nature that informs the chapter, here.
Yeah. Sure, of course. So here I have to give credit where credit is due, and that is to say that Catherine Yeh wrote a lot about the she uses the expression migration of the genre from Europe to the Philippines, to Japan, and then to China, and he talks about the political novel in the manner of the Israelis Coningby. Looking back, Bellamy's Looking Backward has a similar trajectory in that it informs, it was translated, let's say assimilated at the beginning, summarized, abridged. It circulated in different forms at the turn of the century. And it was fascinating to me that it's almost like the text itself gets translated, mistranslated, cut to pieces, and it fragments all over the literary landscape, and then elements of the text are picked up all over the place, and so they resurface in the novels that I myself worked on. And it's fascinating when you actually look at the text and how I tried to do were two things, basically. The first one was I tried to look into how the translation, the first summarized translation that was given by Timothy Richard in 1892, 93, if I'm not wrong. I have a really bad memory. I tried to see how that particular translation was received, and so you have Kang Youwei writing about it, you have Tan Setong mentioning it somewhere, and then I followed the genealogy of Bellamy's Chinese translation till the 1910s, when you have a proper, well-informed, well-written, and faithful translation of the text. But even before that, you have elements of Bellamy's novel circulating and getting into the DNA of what was being written locally, you know? And so this is one thing. I also realized that you have specular mirroring representations of how the future should be. You know, if you, Bellamy's Looking Backward was highly criticized at the time. Many critics thought it was like a socialist generation of the United. What he was representing was a socialist laden degeneration of the United States. So people wrote against it. One of the sequels that Bellamy's novel got was this Looking Further Backward by this Vinton guy, who was, I think, is a very, very, very minor. I'm not a super expert on American literature, but I'm pretty confident it's a very minor writer at the margins of canon. And he wrote a critique of Bellamy's that made use of the yellow peril trope to dismantle Bellamy's utopian ideal. So what this Vinton says is, if we really do like you suggest, if we really adopt the form of government that you are pushing for, so if we nationalize all industries and we eliminate corporation and we get rid of private property, if we do that, it's going to take no time for the Chinese to come here and invade us, right? So this is the yellow peril menace looming over. And then the rest of the novel is of looking further backward. It's presented as a history lecture in which this Chinese professor goes to a college in Boston and tells an auditorium of like American students how they lost control of their country and now they ended up being invaded by the Chinese. But this is not. But then it takes things a step forward, further, and it says that, well, of course, this is the speaking voice, the point of view is that of the Chinese professor, as it was imagined by this American author. But anyway, toward the end of the novel, what started as a dystopian take on Edward Bellamy's utopian vision turned back again into a sort of transcultural utopia in which the differences between Chinese and Americans are somehow mediated or neutralized, you know. So the description of the Chinese I would say the Chinese states of America described at the end of this novel is actually pretty good. You know, it's not such a dark scenario as the beginning of the novel makes you think it's going to be. And so what's funny to me is that this kind of visions of the future in which China becomes this new world power somehow overlap, or if they don't overlap, they pointed completely opposite directions. So what is for Vinton a dystopia of Chinese colonization is for the Chinese the utopia of China as the new world power. So when they do not overlap, they respond to each other as the negative and the positive of a photography. And this is not only my own reading of this text, my own desire to put them together, but rather if you actually look at the circulation of some of these texts, at least, you find the traces that bring one text being read and translated and assimilated and rewritten from one side of the world to the other.
Yeah, and you know, in the introduction, you present chapters 4 and 5 as a unit that expands the concept of utopian spectacle, right? So we have a new term here. Right, and the main parts are Wu Jianren's Xin Shi Tou Ji and Lu Shu'e's Xin Zhongguo, right? So, so then, I was wondering about the connections and the line of thought between spectacle and utopias, you know, both theoretically and narratively for these chapters.
The spectacle, well, I was trying to be fancy and quote French philosophers, you know, as we all do. But I guess the basic idea would be that there's a, as I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, there's a level of narration and a level of description and a level of intention, let's say, that overlap or do not overlap in the writing of these texts. There are claims made by authors that say they want to present a particular vision of the future. There's the matter of the text, of what is being given. And then there is what is missing from the text, what readers, informed readers, like we could be right now, would expect to find, but actually do not find when it gets to the matter of the novels, right? So when my reference to the notion of spectacle was both figurative and literal. Figurative in that it seems to me there's what is being presented in these texts is a sort of Potemkin village, right? A sort of facade. A facade of utopian progress, a facade of post-colonial, of these post-colonial scenarios in which the world order is, the late 19th, early 20th century world order is reversed. And so China in this particular case moves from a position of semi-colonial or hypo-colonial, if you listen to Sun Yat-sen, from a position of hypo-colonial subjugation to one of hegemonic centrality. So there is sort of this narration of reversal that is given as a figure, you know, as this description of ideal cities, of this beautiful city of Shanghai being super technological and clean and the new hub of the new capital of the world. They're also this is a very well presented facade. The point is that once you start to try to look behind the curtains, behind this scenography, you realize that there are certain important elements of the narration that are not given, that are missing, for example, how do we get there? You know, discourses about the economic foundations of such a state, or the way we may concretely move toward this utopian landscape, these utopian arrangements. And to me, when the text tried to go there, the whole narrative structure break down. If you think about the new story of the stone, which is pretty niftily conceived as a 20 plus 20 chapter novel, in which the first 20 chapters are like a satirical take on late imperial China, pretty much in line with many other novels written at the time. And the second half is its utopian counterpart. When it comes, though, to move from the first half to the second half, the narration breaks down. And this is particularly clear in the New Story of the Stone, in that the plot somehow refuses to make sense. Characters are lost. Characters are left apart. There's a sort of like unreliability in the way the story is told that somehow makes it difficult to properly articulate the passage, you know, to properly articulate how we get to the utopian part of the text, which is similar to the Thomas More episode, in which when somebody asks for where utopia is, somehow the message doesn't get through for reasons, you know. So there's that. So that's the spectacle to me. It's a spectacle to the extent in which it's very much consciously put forward as an arrangement of symbols. But like when you're at theater, if you move behind the stage, you realize how everything is made up in a way that for the public it makes sense, you know. But only if you stay in the position of the public, you know, in the carefully arranged position of the reader who is given this image of this utopian image, which is what the text was doing in the first place. If you write to educate, to teach, to give, to push for a particularly to push for a particular ideological perspective, then of course you're putting the reader in a certain position so that he or she looks at certain things and not others, right? Or gives priority to whatever aspect you want to be given priority as the provider of this message, of this novel, of this piece of text. So,
yeah, very, very interesting. And, you know, the process and the mechanics through which this, you know, the attention towards certain ideas or, you know, certain passages gets focused in the text, I think it's worth exploring further. And You know, I think there's so many conclusions and so many paths you can draw and take that, you know, I assume that writing the conclusion part must have been quite hard. So, you know, I was thinking about what would be the main points that you want the readers to take away, or, you know, maybe kind of an enticing type of being like, read my book instead of knowing about the conclusions. But yeah.
Oh, geez, this is hard. I wouldn't know. So this is a really, this is maybe what kind of point we. It's like don't you think that writing these books is like when the climbers are asked why would you climb Mount Everest and they answer because it's there. You know, I wasn't really thinking about making a larger point of what I was doing. I found these texts and they were there and I thought nobody's writing about them, so I'm gonna. I'm just going to give you something interesting to think, to give the listeners something interesting to think about. So when I was last time I was in Beijing was in 2015, and right before the Shanghai Expo. Anyway, the Expo was a big thing back then, and it just, and so that was the main talk around town, and I remember that I just started to explore this Lei Ching writing, and I found this novel, a new edition of the Xinjiang World, the New China by Liu Xia, one of the two texts I focus on the fourth and fifth chapter. It was republished in this really fancy, shiny red, bright red cover, hardcover edition, and in the cover, it had the main pavilion, the main building of the expo, and then this note that said, I'm translating from memory, so I may be wrong, but something in the lines of what we were dreaming 100 years ago, we are realizing it today. And in fact, this Xinjiang Wall by Lu Shi was written in 1910. It was basically a rewriting of Bellamy's Looking Backward, in which this character falls asleep and wakes up in the 1950s. And he realizes that Shanghai in the 1950s has become the center of the world, and all nations of the world are convening in Shanghai to celebrate this new era of Taiping, of peace, of like universal peace. And so what is being given in the text written in 1910 is something, I would say, comparable to what the Expo was trying to do in 2010. So to say, it gives this sort of a new narration, you know, new sort of end of history or beginning of a new history kind of a narration. And so it doesn't... It's funny to me that somebody back then in 2010 decided, actually remembered that 100 years before there was this really minor text that was exploring these future possibilities and decided to use this text, you know, to reframe and repackage this text in the around the time that the expo was taking place, you know. And it's funny to me because, to be honest, it's bad to say, but, you know, we're not talking about Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, you know. It's not major. We're not talking about major contribution to world literature. These are very, unfortunately, it's a genre that gets formulaic and repetitive very quickly, you know. So the thing is, regardless of the actual quality of how engaging the novel is, somebody decided to publish it in 2010 and using it as a sort of proof that there was a grand scheme of things that was turning out right exactly as it should have been, you know. So I don't know. I guess this is my... this is my final take on the whole thing. <And then. laughs>
Well, I mean, before the final take, you know, I wanted to invite you, or, you know, even just to ask whether there is something else we didn't go over today, but you would really like your listeners to know, you know, either about the period you're talking about, the book, I don't know, specific events.
Just, I'm going to pat myself on the back briefly. If anything, there's a... I translated a lot in the, probably you noticed as well, there are many long bits of translation that, you know, these texts are not really easy to engage. And so I suppose that's something I'm really proud of, in that I had an original side project that never became concrete. So what I wanted to do was, initially I wanted to translate these texts, but then I realized it was too much and they were not always so engaging. So I figured, why don't, a cool thing to do would be to go back to the corpus of text and maybe compose a hyper novel with the most interesting sections of those texts, the texts I explore in the book. I think it would make for a pretty cool and engaging project doing translation, and that I never did, but still there are fragments of it in the book, and maybe the most consistent translation that you can find is the New Year's Dream by Cai Yanfei, which is such a bizarre short story, because Cai Yanfei was not a novelist, he was an educator, a philosopher, an anarchist, an Esperanto supporter. And the only piece of fiction that he wrote was, as a youngster, was this piece of utopian fiction, you know? And it's pretty peculiar to me that such an important figure, the founder of Academia Sinica, the president of Beida, when he decided to try his hand at fiction, he went for this kind of writing, right? It's just... fascinating to me, and that's why, and it offers a really good starting point to get familiar quickly with the genre, because it's a short story, it contains all the tropes, the themes, the tones of the particularities of the genre. So
the short story is really, really interesting, and, you know, even if you're not, you know, as a scholar, or, you know, just a person interested in utopian fiction, even if you're not particularly, interested in translations, but it makes a lot of sense, and it's definitely well positioned inside the analysis of the book. So definitely I'll check it out again.
To be honest, you're the first person I'm talking to who actually went through the whole book. Of course, I'm not considering the peer reviewers of my supervisors or my mom, but you're the first external reader that actually with whom I'm actually engaging.
No.
I was a bit scared, you know.
Absolutely, and I'm honored to be the first you talk to about this, and definitely I would like to expand more on the book, and, you know, I have a lot of other questions, but I know that right now we already taken a lot of your time, so I just wanted to ask you, what are your other projects, your, you know, summer projects, what are you working on right now that excites you?
That's a tough question. I've been struggling a little bit recently to find some really cool long-term project to engage with. The thing is, I keep getting drawn back to the late Qing period. I think there's so much to say about it. I'm thinking about working around travelogues and travel writing in a twofold perspective. I'm writing a project about fictional and factual travelogues in early modern China, in which I'm trying to put together different, let's say that as China was becoming part of the world at large in the late empire, a lot of people writers were like traveling and writing about the travels, or maybe they were writing about imaginary places and setting these travelogues in a fictional context, what I'm saying is that there's a strange shifting between fictional and factual narrations in travelogues that were, to me, they look a lot like attempts to kind of mapping the new world that was expanding around as the borders of the empire was falling apart. And so I think there's something to say about it. So this is what I'd like to do. So yeah, I hope that I can make something out of it. We'll see.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward. And it sounds so interesting that I think a lot of the listeners would also look forward for the next book or, you know, the next article or, you know, anything that would come out of it. And for now, I would like to thank you very much for agreeing to speak to us about your book. And I wish you good luck.
Thank you.